Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wounded Blue Hour here on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. I am a 34-year law enforcement veteran retiring out of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I'm also the author of a number of books, including the soon-to-be-released Rescuing 911, The Fight for America's Safety. And you can get your notification about that at rescuing911.org. But I'm also the founder of the Wounded Blue, the national assistance and support organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers, a nationwide charity that's helped more than 13,000 American law enforcement officers injured either physically or emotionally and psychologically. And of course, this show is dedicated to the physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being of America's law enforcement community. Thanks for joining me here at the Wounded Blue Hour. As we do on every episode, I talk about what is called our reality check, and that's about the violence that law enforcement faces every single day. And unfortunately, today I have to read the name of another officer who lost his life, who was murdered in New York City. His name was Police Officer Jonathan Diller of the New York City Police Department. Police Officer Jonathan Diller was shot and killed during a traffic stop near 1919 Mott Avenue in the Far Rockaway area of New York City. At 5:50 p.m., Officer Diller and his partner approached a vehicle that was stopped in front of a bus stop. Despite being asked numerous times to exit the vehicle, the subject refused. He pulled out a gun and shot Officer Diller in the stomach, striking him under his vest. Officer Diller was able to get the gun away from the subject, and his partner shot and wounded the suspect. Officer Diller was transported to Jamaica Hospital, where he succumbed to his wounds. The subject, who had an extensive criminal record, was taken to Jamaica Hospital and, unfortunately, is in stable condition. Officer Diller had served the New York Police Department for 3 years. He is survived by his wife and one-year-old son. Police Officer Jonathan Diller, New York City Police Department, End of Watch Monday, March 25th, 2024. This underscores several things. One is that the criminal issues facing American law enforcement are staggering, but the assaults on law enforcement officers has risen dramatically. Last year, although the FBI statistics have not come out yet, the year before, when they did, more than 60,000 American law enforcement officers were physically assaulted in the line of duty. They were shot, they were stabbed, they were beaten, they were hit with bricks. And of course, many lost their lives. But in addition to that, some of those injuries were devastating. They were life-changing injuries, which of course is why the Wounded Blue exists, to help those men and women. But each day, we are seeing an increase in the threat level towards American law enforcement. Last year, 378 police officers shot in the line of duty, more than one a day. So that is the reality that faces every single law enforcement officers when they put their uniform on and when they go out to serve and protect. They deserve our respect. They deserve our admiration. And those of you who are serving, you have a right to be proud of yourselves for the noble job that you do. Each week, I try to bring you a guest onto this program that is fascinating, that has a lot to say about the topics that we talk about here on the voice on our show here. And you're going to be blown away by my next guest. Her name is Dr. Olivia Johnson. I'll read her bio. She is a veteran of the United States Air Force, a former police officer, and suicidology researcher. That's not that easy to say, suicidology. Dr. Johnson holds a master's in criminology and criminal justice from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and a doctorate in organizational leadership management from the University of Phoenix School of Advanced Studies. Dr. Johnson is the founder of the Blue Wall Institute, where she provides consulting, needs assessment, and training to organizations and agencies in need. Welcome to the show, Dr. Johnson.
Hi, Randy. Thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. I've been wanting to get you on the show for a long time. You and I share a mutual friend, Jason Harney, who, of course, is the filmmaker who created the amazing documentary film, The Wounded Blue. And for my listeners and viewers, if you have not seen this documentary, go to Amazon.com and rent this film, The Wounded Blue. It is amazing. And Dr. Johnson has been featured on at least one of Jason's new film projects. Is that not correct?
Correct. Is there something going on at home? Yeah, Jason is amazing, isn't he?
He is indeed. He transitioned from being a sergeant on the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, where he always had an interest in film, to now being a full-time filmmaker. Very talented man, just an incredible human being, and I saw your film, and very, very dynamic. Is there something going on at home, which really points out the issues that law enforcement families face, and that's right in your wheelhouse, is it not?
Oh, it absolutely is. We're finding that even though the job is a piece of that component, there is so much more going on behind closed doors that many of us are unaware of, and this film could not highlight it any better.
So we're going to probably get a little more into the film just a little bit, but I want the viewers and the listeners to get to know you just a little bit. You know, you've got quite a pedigree, you know, from being a military veteran to being a police officer. If you would, talk about where you grew up, what led you to a life of service?
Yeah, so I grew up in Eastern Iowa. My dad transferred jobs before I went to high school. I ended up in Illinois. My apologies up front for that, right? There's a lot of issues going on in our state right now. And then after that, I ended up joining the military. I just wanted something different. I wanted something better, and I wanted to see what was out there. So I did 8 years in the military. When I got out, I did a little bit of everything, but I found that you know, PI work, bail bonds, I decided eventually I found law enforcement. I went, okay, I'm going to try this out. So I got about 5 years in law enforcement when I was still working on my doctorate at that time. And I realized very quickly that I wasn't going to make the money that I wanted in law enforcement compared to what I could do on the training side.
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that the officers weren't well paid where you were? Are you kidding?
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, there was a time that I was driving an hour and 15 minutes one way. I absolutely love my job, but I realized very quickly that, you know, I needed to do something bigger here, and I just felt a calling. My only other female in my academy class, sadly, was killed in the line of duty, and it was because she was driving too fast for conditions, and there were some other issues going on. And I said, you know, we've got to do better. She'd only been on the weeks, you know, on the road for 2 weeks, newly engaged. It was horrible. And I realized at that point I needed to do something different, and we needed to really look at our wellness in a big picture. And when I started looking at those cases, I actually started coming across the suicides, and I was really was not prepared for that. I'll be honest. I had no idea that suicide was even an issue, nor did many of the people I worked with when I brought it to their attention. So I felt really kind of
blindsided. Let me stop you there. Cause this is a critical moment in your training. And when did you go through the academy, by the way?
Okay. So that would have been back in 06. It's been a minute. I'm almost 50. So
well, 06 is not that long ago. So in 06, the academy wasn't talking anything about mental health with law enforcement and suicide. Is that correct?
No. In fact, the people that I brought, I mean, I'm talking to, I went out and I'm talking to chiefs and lieutenants and line officers just from part of my research. And I would ask them, are you familiar that, you know, are you aware that this is an issue? Not that it's an epidemic, but are you aware it's an issue? And they're like, no, it's not. And then I started showing them cases and they're like, wow, I didn't realize that. So we were all blindsided. No one's ever mentioned suicide to me in this career.
Okay, so you began seeing that there was an issue. Go on. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I wanted to reinforce that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and that it, and it really didn't pick up speed for a while either, because it wasn't until like 2008 to 2010 that people started actually talking about it. So I was working on my doctorate, and I had to do a survey. So I called these agencies, and I would say, "Hey, I'm doing this survey. I found that this is an issue. I'd love to address it." And I would get phone call after phone call saying, "Hey, Olivia, we appreciate what you're doing, but we don't have a problem." And I'm like, "Wasn't that something?" So the phone, you know, every time, and it would just be click, click, click. And I finally said, "What the hell's going on here?" Well, about 6 months down the road, here's where the phone calls changed. I'm getting the phone call now, and it's saying, "Hey, Olivia, we've had a suicide. Now what do we do?" And I said, "Well, this isn't going to work for me. This isn't how this shit works, right?" So you can't call me after a suicide happens. I can't do anything. I said, "So you can either call me on the front end for training, or you're going to have a liability issue and you're going to call me at the end." I said, "It's your choice." And, you know, sadly, you know, those still happen. I still get the phone calls here and there, not as many when something bad has happened, but they're starting to see that you can't wait until you're in dire straits and expect me to come in and do some kind of magic, because it's not going to happen.
When let's go, I want to go back to your police career. When you joined the academy, this was just something. You didn't have a lifelong desire to be a cop. This is something that you wanted to give a try to. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I still don't sometimes know what I want to do when I grow up, but it was just something that I wanted to try. And I always had this need to serve others. And I felt like it was a really good fit for me. And it was. I mean, I was able to serve people in the community. I just felt like I fit there. And so it worked for me, you know, when I was doing that, just like the military. It gave me a purpose and it gave me direction. And I really felt like that was what I needed. And then I think the more that I started looking into some of these topics, I started seeing some of the complacency in the places that I worked. And I started seeing some of these issues. And I knew that they were much bigger than what I was seeing. And I think the more that I dug and dug, I started realizing that my calling had started to change, and it was more of giving a voice to these issues and to bring about a bigger picture, if you will, for people to see. And it kind of took on a life of its own. I mean, probably in the last, I mean, I've been doing this over 15 years, at least in the research side. And I've got to be honest, I feel like it's taken on a whole new life of its own. And probably the last 2 years, it's really ventured outside of even law enforcement. It's gone into other occupations. But it's the idea that these are people, and I know cops, and you know, we get, you know, that whole blue, you know, the Blue Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. I don't do any of that because I know cops believe that all lives matter, and I know that they care about people that they serve. So I know that even though those are kind of mantras that go around, my idea is all lives matter, because these are somebody's family member, and if we're dealing with it one way or the other, Randy. We're either going to be dealing with it in our own lives, or we're going to be dealing with the people on the street. So we really need happy, healthy, stable people. And if we can do that, we're going to do our best to, you know, to make that happen. And I just felt that my calling had started to change a little bit. And I absolutely love research and I love speaking. And I feel like that's kind of where it took me.
So while you were going for your doctorate, this is the topic that you that moved you to get to do your thesis, is that correct?
Yeah, so I actually started, I was honoring my friend who had passed, and I was going to do vehicle accidents and why were we driving too fast for conditions, why were, you know, all of these things. I had my whole dissertation almost written. And I, at that point, said, "Nope, you can't do this. You cannot do this any longer. You've got to change it." So I actually changed it. I completely took
Well,
that dissertation and
you
said it
changed your
was
dissertation
back.
after.
I did.
You, oh, that's a major deal. That's a
Yeah,
major deal.
it was major. I felt like I had talked to quite a few experts in the field at that point, and I had everything kind of set out. And though vehicular accidents, again, are a leading killer for us, and you know, it's one of those things, but I just didn't feel the passion that I felt when I saw the suicides. It was definitely something that caught my attention, and I felt like no one was talking about it. And I felt that, you know, I had just been given a voice to talk about these difficult things, and it worked out for me, and I changed everything up. Sadly, I lost my firearms instructor to suicide, one of the first suicides that I remember as far as law enforcement goes. So after that, I can count quite a few, sadly, but I feel like we're getting the message out and we're doing it a different way than anyone else.
Okay, good. That leads me into where I want to go next. So now you've been in this field for 15 years. That's a substantial amount of time. And I, the word that you used in your bio, suicidology. Okay. I've never heard that term before. And I've been in the realm now for quite a while. And yet this is the first time I've heard the word suicidology. And it's a fascinating word because it means the study of suicide.
Right.
And tell me how, well, first of all, did you coin that phrase?
No, absolutely not. It's just, it helps people to understand what I do. So it really is the study of suicide. And I study different groups in general, because I sit on a couple boards in my county for suicide, you know, prevention is what they call it. I'll give you a different name for that in a little bit. We call that inoculation, but we'll talk about that here in a minute. But I really look at suicide much differently and more in depth than probably many people. So that's kind of where this took me. So in 2016, 2017, we had started seeing a certain group was putting out numbers regarding suicide deaths. And there was no context to it. There was no idea of what was going on here. And a number is a number, you know, is like Dr. Jory Crossan from the Blue Wall says, you can torture numbers enough to make them, you know, kind of what they want to be for you. And I felt like at some point,
That's a great phrase. I think I'm going to adopt that phrase.
And it's true because, you know, you can throw out a number and then everybody will ask, well, what is that? And you'll say, well, it's all law enforcement. But when you start digging deep down, you realize it wasn't all law enforcement and there's some problem with the issue that at hand. So I said, listen, I thought about counting numbers a long time ago and kind of addressing that. But I said, the numbers don't do anything for us. If we're not digging deeper than that and we don't find out what's truly going on here, nothing's going to change anyway. So that's when we decided at that point that we were going to do, you know, we were going to do this differently. So when I find a case or I get a case or someone says, hey, I think this could be a possible suicide death, we verify 100% before it goes in our database. So we get autopsy, toxicology, police reports. We go back a minimum of a year on all social media accounts we can find. We look at interactions. We look at pictures. Anything that we can find on the site. We also do a background on Google and try to find out anything that might have been pending in the person's future, you know, past, if you will, like any cases or anything. So we pull everything and we get a psychological autopsy built off of that. We get interviews with family, friends, and coworkers. Of course, not for every case. And we can't get information on every case because some states are closed states, which means you don't get these documents. But we put together a psychological autopsy for every case. And we've built that from the American Association for Suicidology off of their template and off of the military. And we've devised probably 100 more questions on our own to really make it a different vantage point, if you will, from each case. There's always many, many pieces, like you said, to the puzzle. And everybody has a different piece of the pie. So we look at this big picture and then back into the details as well.
The psychological autopsy. Now, that phrase is powerful. This is not a phrase that you hear frequently. This is something that you developed, is that correct?
No, I did not develop the psychological autopsy. That's been around for quite some time. And there are people that discount it. But the truth is, there's a lot to be gained on understanding someone's life in the last year, in the last month, in the last week, in the last day, in the last minutes of their life. There's a lot to be looked at there. So what we did, Randy, is we took all that documentation. I've put it in a digital database, and I also have hard copies because I'm really I'm old school. I like to have a file. I know these people by name. I know them by face. I know these cases, and they're very dear to me, and I protect them. But what these cases have done for us is we have boiled down the information in over probably 700 cases when we took a snapshot. So between 2017 and 2019, we got published and our data was published as far as, you know, a book. But we took those 700 cases and we said, okay, what's really going on here? And we came up with what we call the Fatal 10. Now that I did develop. So the Fatal 10 is really 10 factors that were noted in a majority of completed suicides. And we took that and we said, okay, this is huge because now this changes how we train. This changes how we educate. This really changes the future of kind of where we're going with this whole thing. And it really has. It's taken on a life of its own.
The Fatal 10. I want to do a deep dive into that. That we'll do that after I have to take a break in just a couple minutes. And this is such an important topic. I don't want to be stingy on the time that we devote to it. So we're going to get right back to that. A question that I have, how has law enforcement responded to you and the research that you're doing? Are you getting cooperation? I know that when we're talking about, you know, gathering information on suicides, law enforcement suicides, man, this is a really, really rough, this is a rough category for police agencies to talk about. Are you getting cooperation from the majority of agencies that you contact?
So I'll say yes, but I also have kind of this back piece. So what people need to understand is that for far too long, I think we have really given an excuse, if you will, for suicides in general, saying that they're all job related and PTSD. And our data isn't showing that. Our data is saying, yes, this might be a piece of it, but the bigger piece is how we handle the stress, how we handle the trauma, and then the negative consequences that come with those actions, such as drinking, drug use, you know, gambling, those type of things. So if the suicide is not really well known, like let's say there were no circumstances surrounding it that might have made it look bad, or there were criminal activity, agencies are more likely to call us and let us know. If there's something in the officer's past or something has come out, more than likely we won't hear about it. Or when we hear about it, there'll be undertones of something happening, but no one's really clear on what it is. So let me give you an example. In the Fatal 10, one of our factors was being under investigation. We had, out of those 700, it was a small group. So statistically speaking, this is still small. But three or four of those cases were officers that were involved in shootings, and they were good shoots. They were merely waiting to be cleared. What happened is they had isolation, they were drinking too much, they had arguments in the home, they weren't sleeping. So there was a lot of stuff happening, and it just really, the stress had built up and they couldn't take it. The majority under investigation from this very small group were under investigation for child sex crimes. And many people are flabbergasted when I say that. But I also say, listen, we're researchers. We can't hide the truth, and we're not going to hide the truth to fit agendas. So we don't like that. We don't want to say that we like that. Obviously, that's a really big black eye for law enforcement. But what we need to understand is these are people problems. And anytime you have people in the mix, you're going to have issues. So we start looking at, you know, things like, how did you get into this job? How were you, you know, how did we miss this on a background? We start to look at different, you know, many different concepts here when we know this information, and knowing this definitely has changed my mind on some things as well.
That's fascinating. That's really, it's also disturbing, but, you know, when you're talking about that, I want to just deviate just a little bit, because this is something that I found that shocking to me. You're of course are familiar with the utilization of a therapy for delving into people's past with the eye movement desensitization, EMDR.
Yeah, EMDR.
Now, when I was talking to a practitioner of that, he told me something that really, really shocked me, that very often what comes out from EMDR is not the suspected trauma that was the catalyst for going into, for actually getting EMDR, but they found that there was often in the past sexual abuse that occurred to that officer, and that was something that just came out of nowhere, if you will, and had played a role in the future for post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, and we're actually, and I'm not a clinician, so I can't speak to the ins and outs and workings of EMDR, but I know it doesn't work for everybody, but when it does, it's been phenomenal. But what I will speak to is that what the research is showing is that what often happens, and why we kind of have this idea that everything is job related, is because oftentimes there are traumas in someone's childhood, those adverse childhood experiences, and what happens is they've been buried. They're in their baggage and they're way down deep. So by the time that they are triggered, which is usually on the job, they think it's the job in general that's caused this trauma, when it's actually something that they brought with them to the job. So it's kind of understood why that's happening, that phenomenon, if you will, why it's happening. But what we need to understand is everybody has baggage, different types of baggage. But everybody has baggage. And if you don't address it again on the front end, you're going to address it during the career, possibly in liability issues, in lawsuits, loss of life, excessive use of force, whatever you want to look at, you're going to see those issues, because they're thinking that the trauma is coming from the job. And the truth is they probably had something that triggered it, and it was from childhood, and now it's coming back and they've never dealt with it.
It's really interesting. So we got to take a quick break. We'll come back, and I want to get into the 10 factors that that you create and I find absolutely fascinating. So we'll be right back.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/outloud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX Throat Spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. That's AmericaOutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
One Nation Coffee. One Nation Coffee. Patriotic, veteran-owned, very, very good coffee. I actually went down and visited their roasting facility and met with the folks down there, John and his crew, and they are amazing people. The coffee is delicious. You order it online, they bring it right to your house. You can get the ground coffee, you can get beans. I like to grind my own. They've got also got these, the containers that you put in your Keurig or whatever that thing is called. So One Nation Coffee, go to onenationcoffee.com, order your coffee, and you'll get great coffee and you'll be supporting a patriotic company that supports the Wounded Blue. So go to onenationcoffee.com. I want to tell you about another company. This company is very unique, and I love what they do. It's called OfficerPrivacy.com. Now, what is OfficerPrivacy.com? It is a company that was started by a veteran of law enforcement who is absolutely dedicated to officer safety. And he has a certain expertise, and that is in the cyber world. And so what he's created is something that, I mean, came out of left field for me when he explained to me that there is so much information available on the internet, personal information, including about where you live and I live and every law enforcement, all this incredible personal information that you don't want the public knowing is all over the internet. There's all kinds of search databases that I never even knew existed. And what they do at officerprivacy.com is they actually go onto these websites that have your information and take it off. I mean, they removed like 35 pieces of information, including where I live, from the internet. And I was blown away by this. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about officerprivacy.com, he only hires former law enforcement officers or active duty law enforcement officers to actually do the work. So that means you can be, you know, secure in the knowledge that the people that are working there aren't accessing your personal information for any nefarious purposes because they're believers in the cause. So it's not expensive. And I urge you to go take a look at officerprivacy.com, see what they do. And when you, I know you're going to love it. So when you go, tell them Randy sent you, and I'll get a little kudos for it. And Pete James, who owns the company, is a very good friend of mine. So go to officerprivacy.com. All right, let's bring our guest back in. Olivia, or Dr. Johnson, I'll call you Olivia off air. I'll talk to you, Dr. Johnson, when you're on the air. I want to talk about the 10 factors that what do you refer to it as?
So the fatal 10.
The fatal 10. That's a very cryptic title. Very cryptic title. Let's talk about that, how you developed it and what it means.
Sure. So we took all the information that we had put into the database, you know, our autopsies, toxicology, police reports, all of our social media, and it really boiled down into these 10 factors that we noted in a majority of the cases of completed suicide. Now, we also look at murder suicide and we look at non-fatal attempts because they teach us something as well. So, you know, one of the things that we lead off with is one of the main things that we saw in the majority of cases, we're talking 90 to 95% of our cases, is in is relationship issues. So when I see that, I'm going, wow, that's not something that I'm going to go, hey, I don't get this, because most of the cases that we were looking at were having relationship issues. They were pending divorce. They were pending breakup. There were some serious things going on in the relationship. And we noted that that was significant. That was the first significant thing we saw, followed by the second significant thing, which was substance use and addiction issues. I'll be honest with you. I was very surprised to see the drugs and the alcohol in some of these cases. I think we had a BAC at 6 times the legal limit, which alone could be deadly, but they didn't die by alcohol poisoning. And the drugs that were mixed in there, fentanyl, opioids, you know, things that they were getting off the street, methamphetamine, heroin. I was very surprised by that. We have a whole separate database, actually, that looks at substance use disorders and those that died by overdose or, you know, dying. They'll consider it accidental death, but it's still an overdose death. So we look at those separately, and it blew me away at some of the things that we had in our system at the time of death.
Okay, so...
No, I'm going to...
You touched on something about that I wanted to just talk about briefly, and that is... So the statistics can be skewed because you don't know what's a suicide and you don't know what has been reported as an accidental death, an accidental overdose. I mean, the gun cleaning thing, how about that? You know, he was cleaning his gun and it went off and killed himself.
I got one of those right now, Randy, and it's very concerning because it was ruled as an accident, and this guy was he was a known firearms expert. Those things should not be happening. And, the magazine was taken out of the firearm, but he failed to clear the chamber. I'm like, no. I got to talk to the medical examiner on this. I've got several like that. But we only go with what the medical examiner or coroner rules it. And then I'll put those in a suspicious file because, again, it's been known for many, many years that, you know, you pay out an insurance when it's accidental. I get it. But what happens when we lie about those things and we cover those things up, we're not protecting anybody. What we're doing is actually causing a bigger problem because people now have a way to make it not look like a suicide. So that kind of falls back into what we're trying to prevent in the first place. So those two issues, that interpersonal relationship issue and substance use, were the leading two that we saw in the data. And I can share further when you're ready.
Yeah, let's go in. Let's rock and roll. Sure. With that.
So that third component is stress and trauma. And it really talks about that cumulative trauma that we build up over a lifetime from the time that, you know, you were a young person coming into the job and what you'll get as you clear, you know, this life and you move on to a different career or retire. So it's collective, if you will, that stress component. That was the big one for us when we saw that it wasn't necessarily the trauma and it wasn't necessarily the stressful event. It was how we were dealing with it. So what I started seeing is interpersonal relationship issues, substance use issues, a lack of sleep. We started seeing all these things start to come out in the data that said, listen, it's not the stress, it's how we're dealing with it. And how we're dealing with it, especially when we talk alcohol and drugs, those things have additional consequences. And as we're sitting here, we're aging. So that body's breaking down and all the damage we're doing to our bodies right now in that realm are only going to be magnified as we age. So that third one is cumulative trauma and stress followed by sleep disturbances, right?
Okay. I want to talk about the cumulative stress. You know, for years, the medical community, especially when it concerns retirement, stress-related retirement, did not recognize that there was the cumulative stress was even an issue. This is only coming out now, you know, after years and decades of basically ignoring it, that cumulative stress is a paramount factor when you're talking about post-traumatic stress injury. In fact, there have been laws that there was a law here in Nevada that if you couldn't associate one particular traumatic incident that caused the traumatic stress, it wasn't recognized as real. Is this something that you have seen as well?
I have seen that, but I think for the sake of the research here, what we're seeing is it's not so much those big events or even the smaller events, it's how we're dealing with them. And what we're doing is, you know, listen, I'm a drinker. I'm not going to tell you not to drink. But what I tell people is if that's your only go-to when you're dealing with this stuff, you're going to have a serious problem. Or if you go to drugs or if you go to gambling or sex with people you shouldn't be having sex with, all those things have their own repercussions. So what happens is, and what we started seeing with the research is that they weren't dealing with the stress appropriately because of some of the childhood stuff they dealt with, right? Those adverse childhood events, they teach you as a young person how to deal with stress. And if you don't gather that as a young person and find healthy coping strategies, as you start aging, you just go to what works. And what works now may not work long term. And we saw that because what happened is it's a snowball effect. You start having one issue. Let's say you realize that something's going on in the relationship. You're not feeling it anymore. You start having relationship problems. You're going to start having a lack of intimacy. The next thing you know, you're going to be drinking a little bit more. You're hanging out with your friends. You're not plugging back into the relationship. You're not sleeping as well because you're staying out too late. So it actually starts this snowball effect in the fatal 10, and it starts picking up those other factors along the way. And that's where it gets tricky because people don't expect it. And by the time you realize that you have 8, 9, or 10 of these factors, you're in serious trouble, and you have been for quite some time.
Okay, let's get on to the next one.
Sure.
Yeah,
our mental health disorder. So we noticed that one of the things that stuck out to us is our PTSD and anxiety rates were 15% of that 700 cases. Our depression was 32%. That was a huge one for us. Then we jump to our medical concerns, right? As you're aging, all these things are happening. Then we talk about firearms access. That was the one thing I cannot get rid of. And it's one thing that all of us have as a risk factor if we carry for work. Followed that up by being under investigation. Right. Pending or nearing retirement. We had several that had dropped their papers the day they took their life, and then other major life events.
Wait. Hold on a second. You mean to tell me that at the moment, I mean, every cop I know, when you talk to them, they can tell you almost to the day when they can retire. Oh, yeah, I got 6 years and 4 months and 9 days. You know, it's like the golden ring at the end of the ride, right? And you're telling me just before they grab that ring, that is a factor in committing suicide.
Well, it was noted. Now, what that means is you have to look at that a little bit deeper. So for me, I look at this much differently than probably the layperson just looking at it, because everybody wants to say it's one issue. It's one thing that caused it. And that's not the case. There was only one of those, say, four cases that we knew was planned. They had a big party the night before. They were giving out notes to other people, you know, and it was definitely odd. And it probably caught some people's attention, but they didn't know what to do with it. The other three that we had that dropped papers the same day that they took their life, it appeared to be nothing related to the actual retirement or the dropping of papers, because who's going to waste that kind of time and energy putting it together when you knew that you had a plan in place not to live past this day? So it became an issue of interpersonal relationship problems, health problems, medical debt. There were a lot of things in the background there. So we knew that this wasn't necessarily the component that they were getting near retirement. But what people need to understand also is this. You change when you start to get into retirement. See, when you're talking that you have 10, 12 years left, you're looking forward to it like you see it coming. The closer that it gets, the more stress that builds, because now you realize that it's really a reality. And what happens is people don't really realize the reality until the finality, meaning that once that retirement happens, then all of a sudden all the stuff that you have been wishing for comes to reality, and you realize, shit, I don't have an in anymore at the PD. Everybody stops talking to me. I'm not one of the people, you know, I don't hang out there anymore. They're not calling me with stuff. And then you start to realize that what you had was really what you wanted, but it can't go on forever. And most of the guys will tell me, hey, Olivia, I'm going to fish every day. This is what I got planned. And the reality is they're at home a week after they retire. They're pissing everybody off. Nobody can stand them. And the next thing they're doing is secondary, because they got to get out of the house or they need insurance. So it's really kind of a sad thing. But our perception of what that looks like is completely clouded by the reality of it. And some people can't do that. It's just not going to work for them. So it definitely is a piece of the pie on how they're thinking differently as they get closer to retirement.
This is such a fascinating topic. I feel like I could speak with you for hours about the issues that we're talking about now. That the retirement one is mind blowing, and I understand exactly. You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, I did not intend to retire when I did. I suffered a stroke in my police car, and that's what ended my career. And the loss of and the realization that I was no longer going to be a cop, something I'd done for 34 years, right, was devastating to me. And it was a massive transition for me. And I felt that stress deeply. So I understand exactly what you're saying. And mine wasn't planned. My career was basically ripped out, right, from under me, which is a whole different set of circumstances. But go ahead on with more of the fatal 10.
So in that last one, we talk about other major life events. So foreclosures, major financial component, health of a family member or a loved one. And then one of the ones we saw, which was kind of in the physical realm as well, but the individual had brain cancer. It went into remission. A couple months after it went into remission, lost his wife and adult son. So, you know, and then we have a suicide. So it's really tragic, some of these cases. Some of them, you know, sadly, you can see and predict with some certainty that there's going to be some negative things going on in someone's life. And I think that's what we're missing here is, you know, we need to step back for a moment and we need to start investing in the people. You know, you can't have any business, you know, run without people. And we're dropping that ball big time, all of us. So we took that fatal 10, if you will, and we boiled it down into two major components: interpersonal relationships and purpose. So it's called relational purpose. The reason you do what you do, why you're on this planet, and those relationships are extremely important. And we saw that in the research as well, Randy. People that lacked futuristic thinking, they lacked purpose, they lacked goals. It did not end well because they had nothing to look forward to. So it's something that we really try to pride ourselves on when we move forward. We call inoculation. We get to you before you have problems. You know, you're born and you die, right? But in between, you have ups and downs. And we want to get to you before you have those major downs so that we can address the issues. And they're not as traumatic and they're not as long lasting as they might be had you not had no training. But the idea, and I'll leave you with this too, you know, is the idea of prevention doesn't work. We spend millions of dollars. The return on investment for saving lives is low. So we don't believe in suicide prevention nor intervention because it's very dangerous and possibly deadly to intervene. We believe that prevention is, let's not let it happen again, right? Another suicide, let's not let it happen again. Another suicide, let's not let it happen again. Inoculation is, it never happened in the first place. Because we're gonna get to you before you start having major life events and these fatal 10, and we're gonna set you on a path that is gonna lead you away from the issues and address the issues that come into your, you know, purview faster, so they don't just sit there and stew around.
Inoculation, I really love that term. And that's very groundbreaking. I don't think I've ever heard the term before. And yet, when you say it, it makes perfect sense. So, tell me what inoculation looks like.
So, inoculation really changes the way we see things. It talks on one of the major components of inoculation is conscientiousness. Following orders, doing the right thing when no one's around, making sure you follow doctor's orders, like, you know, being on time. It has kind of this component of, you know, emotional intelligence in there as well, and resiliency. So it's kind of got this whole idea of these major components that come together, and they go, listen, if you're doing the right thing and no one's around, you know, you're always doing the right thing and you're following the orders and the rules and the policies and procedures. If you do it on duty, you do it off. So it kind of has this idea that you kind of keep those bad things from seeping in, and you don't allow bad behavior to cause you additional stress. So it really keeps you grounded in each of these components. Now, I will tell you this. This really is a paradigm in how we talk about, you know, suicide in general and how we're going to, you know, reduce numbers. But many people don't want to hear this. This message isn't, you would think they'd want to save lives and careers and families, but not everybody's on board with this, because I'll be honest with you, when you look at certain things, sometimes it's better to keep people sick and unwell because it runs agendas for other people as well. And we're seeing that, sadly.
Really? Delve into that more. That's a frightening concept.
Yeah, I actually went to do a class, and they said, well, we need the title to be suicide prevention. I said, we don't believe in prevention. Well, it doesn't matter. We just need that in the title. Otherwise, we don't get the grant money. I said, well, we're not doing that. So we don't believe in that concept. So it blew my mind, because I thought, this is the dumbest stuff I've ever heard. Like, this cannot be 2024. And yet it was. And what happens is, you get the same organizations that get the same grant money every year to produce the same results, which is nothing, because the suicide rate continues to climb. And we come in and say, listen, we're not loud. We're not obnoxious. We kind of do our own thing and we offer our services, but we get turned down because we don't fit the mold, or we're told that we're too controversial, or we don't say it's just the job causing these issues. And I said, no, because that's not going to save lives. The truth saves lives, and the data doesn't lie. And yet we get people going, no, that's not going to work for us. And the reason it doesn't work is because they won't get their grant money. And I always say, if you want to save lives, we need to take everybody from across this country, stop whatever you're doing, stop the money coming in, and everybody sit together and say, listen, what we're doing is not working. The suicide rate continues to climb. You're putting out millions of dollars in billboards and pamphlets and gun locks. And shit, I haven't seen a gun lock on a gun in years. I said, we're losing. I mean, it's on everything but the gun. Let's be honest. Stop putting money into that stuff, making people feel safe, and let's figure out what the problem is. And we realize, you know, in my county, I did a study, and the top three groups that were dying by suicide were construction workers, K-12 students in college age, and food service workers. And I went to that second one and I said, there was only one child that was legally able to have that long gun in their possession. The rest of them were all completely loaded, ready to go, and in a, you know, under a mattress, under a pillow. So I said, instead of acting like we're going to give out gun locks again and have this big community festival, let's find out what's going on here. And what I truly believe is going on is that many of these parents are not, they're not familiar with firearms. So they have somebody get the firearm completely ready to go. There's no safety because they don't know how to use those things. And they leave the gun completely ready to go. And they don't know how to unload it. They don't know how to clear it. So they're scared of it. And they just leave it, you know, literally ready to go. And sadly, it turns out very badly. And I think if we were to go back and re-educate on some of those issues, saying, listen, it's not that they don't understand the nomenclature. They don't understand anything about the firearm, how to use it. It's there for protection. We've got to teach these lessons so they understand and they can feel comfortable unloading it and making sure that it's secure and being able to put it back together and you get it ready in case they do need it. But we're missing that component, and we keep throwing out gun locks. And I said, we need to stop doing all this silliness and take a moment and take a breath and go, what can we do differently that's going to have measurable outcomes? And what we're doing is not working.
So now that you've identified something that's critical, the fatal 10, law enforcement is like a big ship turning a very slow turn in the ocean, right? Trying to change course, if you will. We all know how resistant cops are to change personally, let alone organizationally. So this is a mission that you're on, but you've got to have some serious frustrations going on dealing with trying to change this thought process within a police culture that has more than 17,000 different police agencies, all with different leadership, and one thing I want to, we're kind of getting closer to the time we have to stop, but literally we could talk for hours, but I want to ask you this. This is a really important question. I have seen that organizationally, law enforcement officers feel oftentimes betrayed by their department based on the way that they are treated organizationally. Please address that in the few minutes that we have left when it comes down to officer suicide.
Well, and I get that concept. I really do. But what we also have to understand is each of us have personal accountability and we have skin in the game. And we have to step up a little bit more and we have to take some accountability for the decisions that we're making. And not everything comes down from leadership. And listen, they have their own issues. I mean, I have plenty of chiefs and lieutenants and captains in my data as well. So we're at the human level, we're all struggling in some way. But what I think what we're missing here is that everybody has accountability and responsibility to this topic. It doesn't matter who you are. And if you're not happy, you have to figure some things out for yourself and whether you want to stick around. But what I don't want is a lot of these organizations feed into this mindset that we're victims here and we're victims of circumstance and we're victims of trauma and we're victims of this. We're not victims. We have to take some personal accountability here and figure out how to make ourselves well and stay well. And I think by empowering ourselves, we are not necessarily in need of that leadership component, but always being in charge or feeling like they're not supporting us. We can get that elsewhere. And I want to take back that, that empowerment piece for people and realize that this is your, on that big ship, we're all kind of in there and we all have, we have our own direction as well. And we can step up to the plate and we can do some things differently as well.
Fascinating. How can people contact you? I'm sure that the viewers and listeners that are in the law enforcement community are going to want more information from you. How can you be contacted? And tell us a little, about the organization just in the next minute.
Sure. So they can reach us. They can Google the Blue Wall Institute or bw-institute.com. We do needs assessment. We do consulting work. We contract and we do training and research. We really do kind of come in baseline, find out where you're at. If you need a Band-Aid, that's one thing. If you need a tourniquet, we're there as well. We take that fatal 10 and we find out what you need right up front. If you're struggling, we come in with the top three. We take care of those for you. And then we come back in later on and do the additional training. But we can get you on the right track in no time.
So that's for organizations. Do you talk Correct. To people individually as well?
Absolutely. I do confidential peer support on the side. I'm not a clinician, but I get calls every day of the week from families, from spouses, from officers, and from agencies that need help with an officer or a firefighter. So I get all kinds of phone calls.
I can imagine you do. Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be here. And I would like to have you back on because we scratched the surface today, but this topic is so important and it is so near and dear to both myself personally and the Wounded Blue, of course, who is, the organization that I founded. So quickly, about the Wounded Blue. How effective do you feel that peer support organizations are to the law enforcement community?
I think they're effective, but I think one of the things they're missing is standardization. And I think a lot of agencies are kind of willy-nilly. Like I had one agency tell me, well, there's a lieutenant in charge and he picked all of his friends. I go, no, that's not peer support. Number one, no one's going to trust the lieutenant and all of his friends. So I said, listen, this isn't done right. So it really matters on the training that you get and setting up your teams. It's very important. And sadly, we lack that standardization across the board and it can have negative consequences as well.
This is a topic for another day. I want to get deep into that.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for taking the time. Dr. Olivia Johnson of the Blue Wall Institute. Fascinating conversation. You are doing the Lord's work. You're touching lives. You're saving lives. And I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Randy.
So in the few minutes that we have left, I want to talk about the Wounded Blue. We are the national assistance and support organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers. We have a trained peer team. Everyone on my team has been either shot or stabbed or beaten, run over, screwed up, and screwed over. Or they have faced not just physical injury, but emotional injury as well, and come out on the other side. And these men and women are true heroes. They continue to serve. Some are serving from wheelchairs. Some have lost their sight, but all want to continue to serve and do so in very dramatic fashion. So if you're a law enforcement officer, I ask you, I beg you, if you are struggling, contact us at the Wounded Blue. And we have a 24-hour hotline, 877 TWB Talk, 877-TWB-TALK, and you will talk with a peer team member. I ask you to support the Wounded Blue. Go to thewoundedblue.org. We are a charity. We're a nationwide charity. I take no salary, so I want you to be aware of that. Sometimes, you know, charities are under suspicion because, you know, what are you doing with the money? Well, I can tell you this, the men and women of this organization are all volunteers, with the exception of our executive director, and she is a disabled police officer as well. So this comes from the heart, and this comes from a need for this organization. So if you're struggling, please reach out. And I also want to briefly talk about our fourth annual National Law Enforcement Survival Summit. This is probably the most important training you can ever receive as a law enforcement officer or a retired cop, because we all know that when you leave the job, you're not leaving everything behind. And the Law Enforcement Survival Summit will be held this year in Las Vegas at the fabulous Ahern Hotel, a tremendous boutique hotel, September 26th through the 29th. And I can tell you this, that one of my stints in service was being the training director for advanced training for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I went to 1,000 conferences. A lot of them sucked and were very forgettable. The National Law Enforcement Survival Summit will not be forgettable. It has touched lives, it has saved lives, and it is very intimate, it is very important, and it's not even expensive, $325. That includes breakfast and lunch at the Ahern Hotel. So go to thewoundedblue.org, register now, and if you want to support the Wounded Blue, become a sponsor of either the summit or the organization, contact me directly, randy@thewoundedblue.org. That's randy@thewoundedblue.org, and remember our motto, is never forgotten, never alone. This is Randy Sutton. Thank you for joining me here on our show, The Wounded Blue Hour. I'll see you again next week.